This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
And this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Before we have a guest tonight, and a very interesting guest. So stay tuned for a second before we get to him. We have this announcement: PRN.FM. What you're listening to now, this station, is here for a reason. This station has terrific political pro. If you just listen to me, I want you to know about all this. It has great political programming all over, right? All over the week, all over at night. It's got economics programs, it's got arts programming, it's got health programming. So what we're trying to do is build, we have a huge listenership now, but we're always trying to expand it for a purpose. We don't make money here. We're not selling God. What we're doing is trying to make the world a better place. So the more listeners we have, the better. Check in, look at our hosts on our website. And look at the shows that are on there. It'll do you good, believe me. Other thing is that there's a mirror image to this show. If you're on Facebook, it's called Occupied Territory, same as this show. And it's on Facebook, and it amounts to basically a political blog that I write every day. And people respond to it, post videos, post responses. So please do that. Our guest today is Thomas Lindsay, who is head of an organization based in Pennsylvania, but is actually having an effect all over the country. And he is the executive director of an organization called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Hi.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Sure. Oh, you're on the speakerphone there?
I am.
Oh, is there any way to speak directly? Because it has a kind of a echoey sound. It's a little difficult. But if you have to be on it, you know.
We can't change now unless you want to give us a call back, which is fine.
You know what? Maybe we should do that because it's got a kind of an echoey sound, and I want people to hear you. You know,
direct. Okay.
Okay. We'll call you right back. Okay.
Just give us a call back.
Okay. Fine. Thomas Lindsay is the head once again of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, and it's a Pennsylvania nonprofit that advocates for local self-government and the rights of nature. And it's a fascinating organization, and it's been around for about 18 years. And it tries to get local communities, municipalities, towns, and cities to take back their constitutional rights, which have been sort of stolen by the United States Supreme Court and by the executive branch and the congressional, you know, legislation that sort of curtails or liberty or death states rights we're talking about here, but it is going back to the original formation of what the founders of this country, in this case, in individual states, wanted in their own constitutions. Mr. Lindsay, we have you back again, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks for having us again.
I was explaining a little about your organization, and now maybe you can, so people can really know what it's about. The Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, he's the executive director.
Sure. So we're a nonprofit public interest law firm that was created way back in 1995 to do something at that time that we thought was a fairly straightforward thing to do, which was to practice conventional, traditional environmental law. And when I say traditional environmental law, I mean, you know, not to get in the weeds here, but about permits being issued by the state to certain projects like factory farms or sludge that's being dumped in a community or water withdrawal, all these different issues and problems that communities face on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And our job as environmental lawyers were to help communities challenge those permits that were issued. Unfortunately, as conventional environmental law has been over the past 40 years, that when you get involved in that kind of work, it's not about the community actually deciding what it wants. It's actually about, in some ways, enforcing regulations that were written by the very corporations that ostensibly those regulations are supposed to regulate.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though we found ourselves on the winning end of those appeal permits that we were working on for those groups, what would happen in the end was that the corporation would simply come back, build a new, a more complete permit application, and then those projects would be sited in those particular areas.
So, you were fighting small battles and winning them, but not winning the larger war.
That's right. We were losing the larger war, and it took us a while to understand that. And at some point, we decided to do something different, which was to use our skills and whatever we could put towards it to actually assist communities to assert their right to local self-government to stop those projects which are harming them.
So, I've had people on here. For instance, I've had people on from AIKE, the organization down there with Mountaintop Coal Mining. Bob Sinclair. And he was talking about the fact that the state government, he has a very passionate on this, to say the least, the state government of Pennsylvania, for instance, and this is the case with a lot of other state governments, is more or less in the hands of, even the Environmental Protection Agency or whatever it's called there, is in the hands of the corporations down there. So you would have to devise, as you did, a kind of another strategy to take it back, right?
Sure. I mean, we talk about the Occupy movements in the United States. Essentially, the corporations have occupied the law.
Mm-hmm.
So, the regulatory agencies are set up not to protect health, safety, and welfare necessarily, but actually to hand out permits that allow and legalize certain kinds of pollution to take place. And, people still come to us and they say, well, the permit process, the regulatory system is broken. To which we say, maybe it's not broken, maybe it's operating just the way it's supposed to operate, which is to mm-hmm. protect corporations, to get state authority to actually do the types of things that they do. And that's the kind of law that we began to run up against.
Well, it's interesting. There is a segue here, and especially when we talk about this one case, which fascinates me. It's a case that happened in Pennsylvania, a judge's decision. I think it was State Supreme or State Superior Court? I'm not sure.
No, it was actually a trial court in western Pennsylvania in Washington County.
And we're going to talk about this case because what it does is, very clearly, it segues or runs right up against the Citizens United decision, in a way. Because, well, maybe we could get straight to this case because it's really interesting because it has such implications and it's such reverberations for all the law and all other places.
Sure.
Let me just read the first paragraph. A Pennsylvania judge in the heart of the Keystone State's fracking belt, that's the Marcellus Shale, I guess, right, has issued a forceful and precedent-setting decision holding that there is no corporate right to privacy under that state's constitution, giving citizens and journalists a powerful tool to understand the health and environmental impacts of natural gas drilling in their communities. So what are the details of the case from the beginning?
Well, the thumbnail sketch is that there's a family in western Pennsylvania that had alleged that their water had been impacted by fracking activities by a gas corporation. And that gas corporation was Range Resources Corporation in western PA, which is a big player in the natural gas extraction industry. And this family alleged that their water had been contaminated. The company reached a settlement with the family to pay them a certain amount of money and then moved to seal the record so that nobody could learn what the payment was from the corporation to the family. Two newspapers, including the Pittsburgh newspaper, filed a suit to get the settlement unsealed. So you had a secret settlement that was entered into, and then the newspapers wanted to gain information about what the settlement was.
And what was their legal argument for that? Because, I mean, people, when they sign confidentiality agreements and settlements, mm-hmm. That is understood that you just don't reveal it. So how did they argue this? What was the point?
Well, the argument was that the public interest in learning the details of the settlement on a water contamination case outweighed the corporation's claimed right to privacy.
Interesting.
And in a lot of the cases that came before, just to be frank, is that the corporation would win because the corporation would say we have a right to privacy under the state and federal constitution, and therefore that outweighs the right of the public to learn what has been settled through these settlement agreements.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, however, the judge, whose name is Judge Odelica, who's actually the president judge of the Washington County Court, she's been around for quite some time, she's on the bench for about 30 years, issued a decision that said that the claimed privacy rights that the corporation was alleging that they had don't exist under the Pennsylvania Constitution. Hmm. And what she held in some amazing language over a 30-plus page opinion in which she didn't have to write, she could have just held on very narrow grounds, but she instead chose to release an expansive opinion. She said that corporations are not persons for purposes of the Pennsylvania Constitution's Fourth Amendment-type protections. So corporations do not have privacy protections, the same privacy protections that persons do within the state of Pennsylvania.
I was also moved, too, by the language here. I'm going to quote a little bit of it. Is that, you know, there are no men or women defendants in the instant case. They are various business entities. Saying business entities are created by the state and subject to laws, unlike people with natural rights. And she said, in the absence of state law, business entities are nothing. And this is, let's see, this is an interesting little thing. Maybe you can, she says to go on, I'm quoting at random here, that if businesses had natural rights like people, the chattel would become co-equal to its owners. The servant on par with its masters, the agent, the peer of its principles, and the legal fabrication superior to the law that created and sustains it. It almost sounds like it was written in 1776, you know. It's very old-fashioned and very sort of moving language, right?
Oh, it's extraordinary. And in fact, she went on to say that corporations couldn't be, quote, let alone by government because businesses are but grapes ripe upon the vine of the law that this people of this commonwealth raise, tend, and prune at their pleasure and need.
Right.
I mean, that kind of language hasn't been produced by a Pennsylvania court, let alone by any court in the United States for the last 150 years.
No, you never see stuff like that.
And I think what it tells us is that these types of decisions don't come out of the blue. They don't just lower themselves from heaven. They're actually created out of a set of circumstances that emerges on the ground. And so in Pennsylvania, for the past 15 years now, there are 100-plus communities that have actually moved forward to challenge corporate rights within their own communities.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been in this court before, in the Washington County Court of Common Pleas, on a ballot access case in which some folks are trying to place a corporate rights issue onto the ballot and succeeded in actually getting onto the ballot. And so it's about this normalizing of conversation around corporate rights that, mm-hmm. as she says in this opinion, corporations are but property. They're chattel. They're something that's owned. So corporations having rights is as obscene or as far-fetched as your refrigerator having rights,
mm-hmm.
because your refrigerator is owned. It's a piece of property. Yet somehow for over the last 100 years, a relatively small handful of people, being corporate decision makers and corporate law firms, have actually succeeded in obtaining some of these very high protections for corporations and trying to lodge that and have succeeded in lodging that in the text of the federal and state constitutional language.
This is
the first time a judge has really openly thrown that off.
Well, I mean, it'd be interesting to see because inevitably, or maybe I shouldn't say that, but this is going to be challenged. A thing like this could go straight to the people who thought that Citizens United gave rights to corporations as people, right? It could go straight up to the Supreme Court, a case like this.
Well, it could, but it looks like it's not going to be appealed. And
interesting. Oh, really? Good.
What's fascinating about this work that we've done, the communities have done, and this decision itself is that in some ways the corporations are afraid of lodging something like this higher up in the court system. And so they've been relatively leery of bringing those appeals, especially in this case, where the settlement that was disclosed, you know, $750,000 paid to the family for this allegation of contamination of their drinking water. So you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube.
Mm-hmm.
And so they could appeal it on the, you know, very academic rightness of it and try to get it changed. But at the same time, they don't win anything from doing so because the settlement's already out in the public.
Well, also, they might lose something because they went up higher and higher and very higher courts, you know, agreed with this. They would be in more trouble. Right.
It's possible. I think what you're seeing now is kind of a mini tremor, an earthquake that's starting to cause cracks
mm-hmm.
in the way that the institutions operate. And these are institutions that were, in the beginning, actually the ones that gave rights to corporations. And so I think the more shaking that starts to happen, the more cracks like this that will occur.
A case like this, could this be used, cited as a precedent in other state courts?
It can. It's tough to use it that way, unfortunately, because it is a trial court in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And so its precedential value is fairly limited. But we've already seen it being used in Ohio and New Mexico, and language from it has come out in Washington State. Judge Adele Seneca has become a hero of sorts to folks in their own communities who are coming up against this corporate rights stuff.
And possibly also she might be a hero to some other judges who were seeking for a way to do the same thing on state levels, right?
I think that's possible. Once one breaks the code, you know, this unwritten code that corporate rights are so well-settled law that they can't be touched, that sometimes I think it breaks open the dam for others to start doing that as well.
Poor Lewis Powell might be turning over in his grave. He spent a lifetime trying to build up the whole corporate personhood rights, right?
He certainly did, and of course Lewis Powell is with us today in the various incarnations of John Roberts and other Supreme Court justices that hew to his line that law is only as good as it supports the Chamber of Commerce and production of stuff.
What does the U.S. Constitution say, if anything, about the rights of businesses? What rights do businesses have, corporations?
Well, the U.S. Constitution doesn't explicitly or in its text give corporations certain rights. That's a result of court rulings that have come over the years, most notably beginning in 1819 in a case called Dartmouth College, in which the courts closed corporations for the first time in certain constitutional rights. Mm-hmm. But today, as the law sits, corporations are almost full-blown persons for purposes of the Bill of Rights of the Constitution. So corporations have First Amendment free speech rights, which, by the way, was not given. I mean, a lot of people think that the Citizens United case was somehow a change in the law. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. That First Amendment rights were really given full-blown to corporations back in the 1970s. And Citizens United was just another evolution of that. Mm-hmm. But they have free speech rights. They have rights against warrantless searches so that surprise inspections can't be done anymore at workplaces unless there's probable cause. There's Fifth Amendment rights, due process and equal protection, which can be used by corporations now to challenge laws that, for example, treat family farmers differently than agribusiness corporations. Mm-hmm. They have Seventh Amendment rights, 14th Amendment rights. I mean, the list goes on and on. The history of constitutional law in this country has really been an evolution of corporations gaining rights that were previously held only by real, natural, living, breathing people like you and I.
Now, theoretically, if certainly not actually, very often, the Congress of the United States represents the people of the United States. Could they overturn this? Could they enact legislation, or could amendments be introduced to the Constitution to overturn these court decisions?
Well, Congress can't do much from a standpoint of statute, so they can't pass a law, because what the corporate boys have done in a very smart way is embed their rights within the Constitution itself, not within statute. Mm-hmm. And so the only recourse here is at the federal level in some ways, which is changes to the federal Constitution that would override the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's pretty much where our work is focused. It's focused in making state constitutional change to actually eliminate corporate rights from state constitutions, and then eventually build a movement that's powerful enough to force Congress and force the amendment process to operate to chase corporations out of the federal constitution as well.
And now, your organization, Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, could you give the website for people?
Sure. It's CEL, D as in David, F as in Frank.org. So okay. It's the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund.org.
Now, this is something that we've been talking about in this show, which is usually about the whole Occupy movement and about its goals. But there are places all over the country, sort of cities and municipalities in different states where you've had some success, right?
About 150, and in fact, just this past week, there was a county in New Mexico that became the first to ban all oil and gas extraction within the county that we assisted with. Hmm. And so our work is focused on municipalities adopting local bills of rights. We're used to having bills of rights at the federal level and at the state level, but this is about municipalities and communities actually passing bills of rights that inevitably come up, those community rights come up against corporate rights. And then those communities are now beginning to directly challenge the ability of those corporate rights to override their community rights.
Now, I guess, let me ask you this question, which is moving a little far afield. One of the things we see these days is that every 2 years and every 4 years, people turn out to vote for one of the two parties, since a third party isn't even allowed on the platform by agreement from 1987, but that's another story. But And then everybody votes, and we're used to hearing the phrase lesser of two evils. And we keep voting, and we keep voting, and we keep voting, and people campaign, and they seem to be at loggerheads. They're oppositional, you know. And then finally they get in office, and a lot of people are beginning to notice that there isn't a whole lot of difference in the way the government operates, who it appoints to head agencies. I mean, look at the other day. Who did he appoint to be the head of the FCC, you know? So people are, and there was a big article in the Times just the other day about how people under 30, for instance, have become extremely cynical and distrustful of government and politics completely in general. So there is this this sort of this, we're in this Bermuda Triangle now, where, and you know, where people once believed in voting and different candidates. People don't believe in that so much anymore. They're kind of cynical, and for good reason. What is the next step in all this? Because it is, as you mentioned earlier, it seems to me related to Occupy, you know?
Well, I think there's a more basic problem, which is somehow along the line we began to define democracy as our ability to vote. And democracy means a lot more than that. It actually means the people being the source of all governing authority. After all, that's what our constitutions all say. Mm-hmm. And so it's about communities having that decision-making authority and actually moving law themselves. One of our mistakes, and we've been forced into this position over the past 40 years, has been relying on professionals to do that job for us in government. And government has essentially floated in the direction of where the corporate interests and rights and money have been. And now we're in a situation where I would say openly that we don't have a democratic system anymore. And in fact, we begin to wonder whether we ever did, because the U.S. constitutional structure in some ways is about elevating certain corporate interests over community ones. Mm-hmm. And so the basic question is, you know, is the DNA of this country one that lends itself towards that centralized control and centralized decision-making authority? And so getting back to the Occupy folks, you know, I would agree with you. We are in this Bermuda Triangle. The question is, are we going to seize our own communities? Are we going to turn away from the activism of the past, which is focused on federal and state action, mm-hmm. understand that those avenues are now closed to us, and that the only recourse that we have is actually to seize our local communities and begin to turn them against the corporations that have been using them for the past 100 years? Mm-hmm. And that's work that's not for the, you know, that takes a certain breed of people. And that breed of people is not necessarily the liberal progressive community that is with us today. It's going to take a new constituency, a first-time activist. And that's what we're seeing arise in these different communities. But it's all about collective, nonviolent civil disobedience in some ways. Mm-hmm. Whereas the civil rights movement had African-American kids sitting at lunch counters, this is about entire communities beginning to take their seat at lunch counters and refusing to budge and actually using that local structure of law to say we're not going to comply or obey with laws that are illegitimate because they give more powers to corporations than to us, and we're going to force that change to happen.
This is an absolutely fascinating join where that could happen between, because, you know, maybe you could answer this question too. There's a lot of people in the far right who are espousing the same sort of point of view when it comes to local rights. You know, we're not going to let the federal government take away our liberties, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, this is a place where right and left, if they could bother speaking to each other, could really meet, right?
Well, maybe. I mean, vehicles are only as good as the values that animate them. Mm-hmm. So obviously you have different vehicles being animated by different values on different ends of the spectrum. We've been afraid for the past 40, 60 years to actually use those vehicles in fear that we're somehow energizing or enabling opposite value vehicles to take place.
Right.
And I think that's a fear that has kept us in a certain place, always on the defensive, not moving on the offense. And I think there are ways to use those vehicles and tools to move our own stuff forward towards sustainability, because that's what these communities are doing when they ban oil and gas extraction or fracking or water withdrawals from Nestle and those types of things, is that we have to understand that these tools, when they're used in the right way towards the right values, can be a leverage point for us in a world in which ecological collapse in some ways is just around the corner. I mean, things are so bad right now, and so few people really feel the crisis moment, that it's time for those few that feel the crisis moment to actually begin to move with those new tools and vehicles. And I think that's what you see happening now.
Do you find that people who are working with you or are attracted to your website or to your organization who are younger?
I think that's part of it, although we also get a real wave of folks who have been through the regulatory process, in other words, have been activists for 30 or 40 years, mm-hmm. and who have burned out on it,
because
in fact that's how the system is built, is to burn us out on that regulatory activism. And so we get quite a few folks coming in from that as well. And the other constituency we get are folks that live in communities who have never been active before, don't have the regulatory business-as-usual activist stuff in their heads, who are moving forward to protect their groundwater or to protect their air or to protect a local economy or a sustainable energy future that they feel is necessary for their region. And so those are basically the three groups of people that end up coming to us for help.
Well, you know what? We're going to have to end this segment right now, but maybe sometime you can come on my Sirius XM show and tell that audience, too, because I'd love people to hear about this. This is one of the most hopeful things. And you look around, there's not a lot of hopeful things, but this is one of the most hopeful things I've seen in a long time.
It's about picking a fight with the powers that be and picking a smart fight in a way that actually drags them in so that the organizing begins to show itself to other people so that folks begin to understand how the system actually works.
Why don't you give the website again, and I advise everybody, go to this website, because this is the way that we're going to get the country back. If there is no other way, this is the way. Go ahead.
It's the name of the law firm is the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, and our webpage is CELD, as in David, F as in Frank, .org.
All right. Thank you. That's Thomas Lindsay. Thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Okay. Thomas Lindsay, and this is the way. This really is the way that we could get this country back. I mean, there's a kind of it's kind of nonviolent civil disobedience, but he's using state and local, especially local law, community law and state law, and this is spreading all over the place. He's got 150 communities, even Pittsburgh, are challenging fracking companies, oil companies, coal mine, mountaintop removal companies, people who are taking water out of the ground that belongs to us, but they're using it for fracking and everything else, and not challenging on a federal level, EPA, not bothering with Congress people who were bought and sold like prostitutes, but working at the local level, which is how everything started in the first place. So here we are going back, and the judge in this case in Pennsylvania quoted language from 1776, which was written when the Pennsylvania State Constitution was written. So it's really something. I'm going to post this on the Facebook page for Occupied Territory. I think what I'd like to do is take a break. Mr. Engineer, are you out there, Jason? We can take a break and play. We have some music there for break music. And when we come back and talk about some other stuff here. We're back. This is Occupied Territory America. Occupied Territory America, and your host, Mike Fader, here. Don't forget, once again, we have a Mirror Image Facebook page. If you are on Facebook, if you're lucky enough to be on Facebook, you can please check with us. Go to Occupied Territory on Facebook. You can Google Occupied Territory on Facebook. And it's basically a political blog where I post commentary almost every day at this point. And we're getting lots of responses. Several hundred people are checking in each day to look at this, and it's growing all the time. And as I mentioned earlier, if you're just a listener to this show or my other show called The Turning Point on Mondays at 4 p.m., there is more on PRN than just me, a lot more. There's a lot of political programming. There's economics programming, and of the highest level, the most interesting, passionate, intelligent level, and all hitting the right note. Also, a lot of health programming, and we've got some good arts programming, too, and music programming. So check out PRN.FM's website. So this is such an encouraging thing. And how often do you ever hear me say, cynic that I am, that something is encouraging? We finally have, I think, agreed, although once in a while it's impossible not to to be outraged or just plain lampoon the Congress. Congress has become an astoundingly sad, sick joke. I mean, what is their approval level now? 5% or something? Last I heard was that the Communist Party and rats had a higher approval rating than the Congress of the United States. They are an embarrassment to the heart and soul and brains of the original founders of the United States of America. I mean, these people are really something. You will notice that just the other day, it took them, I don't know what, a day or two to interrupt the sequester, which couldn't be touched. It couldn't be touched, which is causing tremendous harm ongoing all through the United States on an ongoing basis. Let me give you an idea. Organizations and companies, and this is from Huffington Post, have begun laying off workers, while many have decided not to staff vacant positions. Schools on military bases are contemplating four-day weekly schedules. Schools. We should have some stupider kids, right? We need stupider kids. Food pantries have closed, as have centers that have provide health services. Farmers have been forced to go without milk production information, causing alarm in the dairy industry and the potential of higher milk prices. Workers at missile testing fields are facing job losses. Not such a bad thing. Sometimes. Federal courts have closed on Fridays. Public broadcasting transmitters have been shut down. On the national level, sequestration, is not being felt so much because those people at the national level are the people who have the money, including people in Congress. And there's some people that they interviewed across the country. For instance, here, quote, absolutely, we're feeling the effects of sequestration, said Kathy Hoskins, executive director of the Salt Lake Community Action Program, which just closed a food pantry in Murray, Utah. I'm using words here, food pantry. Do you know what a food pantry is, right? I worked as a volunteer at a food pantry in my neighborhood in Manhattan. People come there who, without this food, they would starve to death. These are people who are very poor, who cannot speak English, who have no education, who have run on hard times, white, black, Latino, whatever. And they show up at this, the old people, they show up at this food pantry because Social Security sometimes isn't enough to get by on. And food that's contributed, it's at Riverside Church in Manhattan, a very big sort of famous church. And everybody in my entire neighborhood gives them food all the time. And they have contributions from restaurants and some small businesses, you know, that sell food. And they have boxes, a lot of it's generic, but they have boxes of, you know, whatever, cookies, canned vegetables, sometimes meat, sometimes fish, frozen fish that they give out to people. So this food pantry has closed in Utah, which means people will go hungry. People might actually develop serious illnesses from malnutrition. Let's see. The employees at the food pantry are those that are left in this larger organization, which runs a few food pantries, are taking furloughs and have had their agency contribution to their retirement plan suspended. Good luck. Almost definitely we felt the cut, says Michael Jenkins, communications director of the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. The group is closing the Bill Brady Healing Center that provides alcohol and drug treatment to Native Alaskans. On and on and on, says Lachelle Dozier, the executive director of the Sacramento Housing and Redevelopment Agency. This organization helps families in need cover the cost of rent, and it's facing $13 million in cuts this year because of the sequestration. But if we don't come up with the some type of solution or remedy by July, it will equate to 1,700 families losing housing vouchers, which is over 4,800 actual tenants. People will have nowhere to live. no shelter. So all across the country, seniors' food programs, Meals on Wheels are being cut. Head Start programs that give kids a place to go instead of wandering the streets or being alone in houses and who can receive some education. Meal programs for poor kids. Food pantries are closing. People probably will wind up now dying because these rich sons of bitches, including the president and the members of Congress, can't agree on a budget because they're putting their foot down about issues that don't concern regular people. These people are prostitutes for corporate lobbyists, and that includes the president of the United States, who is the biggest prostitute of them all. Well, maybe throw Nancy Pelosi up there and maybe Daryl Issa and a few others. And this is what's going on. The other day, the sequestration, hard word to say, has been in effect for several months now because they couldn't agree on fixing the budget, you know, the taxes that should be increased double, triple on rich people and corporations. No. So the president raised them a tiny little bit, which caused probably tremendous merriment among Wall Street people, corporate people, and basically in rich people. I think that that was the biggest laugh they had in a long time. He raised their taxes, which, of course, they're never going to pay anyhow because they have accountants and lawyers to keep them from paying taxes. Didn't close any loopholes. Well, one loophole was closed slightly. It was papered over a little bit. You know they're not going to pay any higher taxes, but what did Obama agree to? He agreed to a 4% raise in the highest level of tax for people who make over $450,000. That's pocket change to these people. And you know they're not going to pay the extra tax anyhow. And a huge extra tax settled back on the middle class, which already can't afford to get by no matter that they make $60,000, $70,000, or $80,000. We, the middle class in this country, how much can you eat off one, one dead sheep? They are gnawing away to the point where there's not even bones left. This guy Obama, to me, in some ways, nobody could be a worse president than George Bush. He is the all-time worst president there ever was. Certainly in the modern era, let's say starting in 1900, nobody could be a worse president than George Bush. But Obama is a very bad president. He's bad at his job. He's over his head. And when I talk about this guy gives away the store, I'm not talking about, you know this phrase, he gave away the store? It, generally, people understand that to mean he gave away everything in the store. Not only is Obama constantly giving away the store, he is giving away the building that the store is in, and he's giving away the land that it's built on in perpetuity. This guy is a terrible president. He loses every battle that he fights, practically. I mean, he is really a terrible president. So here's the sequestration. It's bound in iron. It's cement is poured over it. It cannot be changed. And principles are at issue here. You know, whether the weapons industry and fracking can go on and weapons can be built at a higher level, where everybody can have 52 guns and shoot their baby sisters and their old mothers every day, like you read in the paper. People are standing on these issues. And you can't raise taxes on rich people. Why? And they'll tell you all the academic reasons and the economic reasons, all of which are bullshit. The main reasons you can't raise taxes on rich people, according to a lot of members of Congress, including a lot of Democrats, is because those rich people get these people elected. They keep giving them money to keep their jobs. And the people in Congress make a starting salary of $172,000. $172,000. And they have all kinds of perks and extras. It's more like $250,000. And these people are constantly going to lunch with lobbyists. They're on the phone with lobbyists. They're having meetings in their office with lobbyists for the tobacco industry, the oil industry, the banking industry, the gun industry, whatever, the weapons industry. This is what they do. They meet with them, or their assistants meet with them all day. They go to lunch with them. They go on vacations sponsored by these people. They are prostitutes. They are whores. And this is meant no disrespect to actual prostitutes and whores who are much more honest and work much harder than the people in Congress, right? So I don't want to, you know, like disparage anybody. But so they couldn't possibly negotiate on their principles, break their principles, and come to an understanding on the sequestration. It had to take place, and it is taking place, and it's ruining people's lives all over the country. But the other day in Washington, they managed to agree to break the sequestration for 1 second and change one thing. Now, did they pick out Meals on Wheels for seniors? Did they pick out the Head Start program? Did they pick out money that was supposed to be given to people to keep food pantries open? Did they pick out money that was meant for drug clinics and for health clinics all over the country? We could understand that, right? You know, well, let's be a little humane here. You know, we can break this wall just for a moment. If we're going to take one little vacation from the sequestration, let's pick out something that concerns people's lives, where they could be thrown out of their houses, or they can't eat, or they're very sick. No, they didn't break it for that. Democrats and Republicans almost unanimously, overwhelmingly agreed to break the sequestration, to restore money to the FAA to hire back flight controllers so that planes would run on time. That was this past Friday. And right after they voted for this and they rushed it through, the first time they've broken this sequestration, they rushed this through, the same people who rushed this through got on planes to go home and go back to their houses and their districts. And then you can be sure that the planes ran on time because they just funded them. That's the kind of people that we're dealing with here. They are shameful people. They are a shame for this country, inside and out. And let me tell you something else. People are always talking to me about the lesser of two evils. Do we finally all agree or understand that the lesser of two evils is still evil and not that much lesser of an evil? Last year, in 2012, you know, I should check and see how much time we have left. Jason, anybody, can you tell me how much time we have left on the show here? Last year, in 2012, because of an expose on 60 Minutes, let me just give me a check on how much time is left. 14? Okay. So last year, in 2012, there was a giant expose last year by 60 Minutes. And what it did was investigate something that people like me and probably people, a lot of people like you, we already knew this, but it was spread all over the country on prime time, on 60 Minutes. They investigated insider trading by members of Congress. Now, Congress granted itself the right a long time ago after, you know, of course, if you do insider trading on Wall Street, well, you're not going to get arrested very much, but maybe a little. You might be in danger. You're actually violating the law if you do that. You can get away with it like most of them do all the time when they sink our economy. But last year after this expose, but Congress, long time ago, exempted itself. There's only one organization or group of people that can legally do insider trading. That is to get special knowledge to give them a heads up or an advance notice of what's going to happen in an industry or with a product so that they can buy stock or sell stock and make millions of dollars. There's only one group where this is legal in the entire country of the United States of America, the United States Congress. Astounding, right? Absolutely astounding. Well, since they were able to get away with trading on insider knowledge, and of course, you know, the heads of companies and industries, and they hear all kinds of things. They're staffers, and they themselves hear it in secret committee meetings. They get reports on industries, you know, oil discoveries. They know about it before you do. Weapons, whether or not we're going to go to war in a certain place. They get all this information in, and they know which company or corporation or even in a whole industry is going to be sailing up or losing and going down. They'll hear about, for instance, if you're on a subcommittee about drugs in Congress, or in the Senate or the House, you're going to hear about the failure of a drug, or your staffer. They have like 20, 30 staffers, these people. You're going to hear about the failure of a huge new cancer drug or something. It didn't pass its test. They'll know about that beforehand. They can dump stock in the company that has done this research. And, you know, when the announcement is made to the rest of us saps, otherwise known as voters, when the announcement is made publicly, by that time, everybody on the inside, including, you know, hedge fund people, Wall Street brokers, and members of Congress have already sold the stock because it's going to go plunging down 50, 100 points or whatever. If you have your pension fund invested, and I'm not talking about, you know, I think most of the people listening to me don't wheel and deal in stocks. Maybe a couple of you do, you know, and you'll have to answer for that. There's karma. But, you know, you have a pension fund, right? You know, your whatever it is, your money that you have in special bank accounts, you know, whatever it's called, IRAs and everything else, 401, 3BKs. I can't even keep track of all this stuff. Your money is invested one way or another, often in these huge corporations or in certain industries. If these industries are going to take a nosedive off a cliff because something is going wrong, the people in Congress know about it first, and their staffers know about it first, and they tell them. How do they know about it? Because of all their inside knowledge. Lobbyists tell them, you know, the same lobbyists that give them money to get elected. They find about it out about it through testimony in front of committees, sometimes closed testimony. They know. Well, they let themselves get away with this for so long. And members of Congress, like Nancy Pelosi and other people in the Congress, Senate, and in the House of Representatives, have made millions, sometimes tens of millions of dollars, immorally, but I can't say illegally, immorally trading on insider knowledge and screw everybody else, their voters, their constituents, and all the rest of us, right? So a stock plunges, a stock has a tremendous rise all of a sudden. They make millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars at the lowest level. They gave themselves an exemption to be prosecuted for this. Last year, because 60 Minutes exposed their behaviors and called people out by name, some famous people in Congress, a law was passed grudgingly against their own wishes. They passed a law, and the president signed the law bill last year into law, which said that they could still trade on, I don't know what the language, what the crap, you know, legal language was. They could still benefit or trade stocks and bonds and whatever it was. But it put more of a limit. It put more of a limit on their ability to trade as an inside traders. And it the main thing it did was, and this was hopefully to curtail this kind of behavior because it's immoral and it's illegal and it's bad for all of us, that they created a transparency. In other words, you would go to a website and you could see every investment, and you should see every investment. You would see every investment that every member of Congress, every House representative, every representative in the House, every senator, and down to a certain point, every member of their staffs. You would see every stock trade that they made. You would see every stock option that they got from someplace. You would see what their holdings were in various corporations or companies. You would see all of this with a few clicks. You would go there. What, and you say to yourself, well, yeah, absolutely. These are the people who should be held to account, a much higher level of accounting than all the rest of us, you know, or certainly at the same level of accounting the rest of us. If you got insider knowledge on stocks, you could get arrested and sent to federal prison. But these people still cannot do that, right? But anyhow, one way to attack that was to sign this law and to create this tremendous transparency, which would have the same effect. In other words, if they're monkeying around and buying and selling things and making millions of dollars off information that they got first in an unfair way, a playing field which was not level, to say the least, then you would know it because you'd see it. You'd click on it and say, Congressman so-and-so or Senator so-and-so did this and did that. And you would know that they were a vile piece of shit, because they were making money on insider knowledge while you were stumbling around trying to pay your rent and buy food, right? And maybe put your kid in through school. So what happened is, now this when you're talking about the lesser of two evils, on April 12th, which is what, you know, no more than about 20 days ago, in the midst of the Boston Marathon bombing, right? All of this, people's attention in the entire country is focused like a laser on this. They hardly know what else is going on or are paying attention. They're horrified by this. They're shocked by this. They're hanging on every investigation and arrest and confession and whatever else there are. When that was happening, when your back was turned, these chickens, these cowards, these sons of bitches, these bastards, and these people in Congress almost entirely revoked this bill that was signed into law last year. It's called, the acronym is STOCK. I don't know what it stands for. STOCK, something about transparency of corporate something or other. So this transparency, which was going to reveal to us or open a wedge to see the tremendous involvement and manipulation of corporations and members of Congress, your representatives, the transparency which was available was neutered down to the point of non-existence. And the president signed this into law. All of this happened in the space of 24 hours. In 24 hours, this group of people, this group of rich hirelings of corporations who could not possibly pass a bill for 2 years to staff food pantries, or it took them 3 years to pass a budget for an organization in the government, an agency in the government, to hire investigators to track down or to follow how bankers were stealing money from the rest of us. No, they can't do that. They can't do anything that's good for us. But what it took them 24 hours. They wrote this bill, and they had it unanimously approved in the Senate. And then it was passed in the House of Representatives overwhelmingly by Democrats and Republicans, and immediately signed into law by Mr. Lesser of Two Evils sitting in the Oval Office. This is what they did for themselves while you were watching what was going on in Boston. So the president is standing up there and he's waving the flag, and there's flags fluttering behind him. He says, we will not tolerate this kind of thing. And he's castigating terrorists. And people in Congress are pounding their desks and saying, these are enemy combatants. The country is in dire jeopardy. We need 5,000 more drones to be built. We need to increase the budget for Homeland Security to spy on Americans. Blah, 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 blah. Meanwhile, while you're all looking at that, this is like being on the street and having some con man, you know, some shell game. He's holding something up in one hand and some pretty bright thing or some strange looking thing. He says, boy, watch this. Meanwhile, he reaches in your pocket and takes out your wallet and you don't even know it. This is the Congress that we have. All of which is to say, A, lesser of two evils, forget about it. You know, the president appoints a couple of good people to Supreme Court. Yay, I'm happy about it. No, I am. That's good. That's very good. He gets upset about gun control, and he puts forth some weak efforts to get some people to maybe pass a bill, which was never passed at all, weak as it was. He fails here. He fails there. The other day, he appoints as a head of an agency. He routinely appoints as the head of federal agencies who are supposed to protect us and pursue the bad guys, people who are the bad guys. He appointed Mary Jo White a couple of months ago to be the head of the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, to crack down on bank lending policies, on banks investing in ways they shouldn't. In other words, what crashed our entire economy and could easily do it again. And, you know, she's the one who's supposed to enforce certain portions of the Dodd-Frank bill. Who is Mary Jo White? For something like 10 years, she was the lead corporate attorney for some of the worst bankers and hedge fund people in the entire country. That's who he appoints to watch out that they're not doing anything wrong. And who did he appoint? Who did Obama appoint the other day to be the head of the FCC? The Federal Communications Commission is more important all the time, because all you hear all over the country is right-wing radio. And one of the reasons for that is because, well, you know, I suppose a lot of people like listening to it. Sometimes they have people, to be honest, who are better broadcasters. And since it's all entertainment, than people on left-wing stations. Not always, but sometimes, right? So they have all these people up there. And so corporations, there's like five corporations, communications corporations, that own something like 2,000 radio stations in this country, for instance. Murdoch, I think, or whoever, he keeps eating more and more newspapers all the time. The Koch brothers are negotiating now to buy the Los Angeles Times and some other famous newspaper. So a smaller and smaller group of richer, really rich people, billionaires and corporations, are controlling all of the media. The FCC is in charge of this. And they can grant licenses or take them away. They can say, no, we can't let you do this because we're supposed to represent the interests of the people of the United States, and we need to keep people informed to have a democracy. Now, the FCC has always been a revolving door of the worst sort. People leave there who are commissioners as opposed to supervise these companies, and they go straight to these companies as executives. And sometimes they go back into the FCC. So who does the president appoint the other day, Mr. Lesser of Two Evils? Who does he appoint to be the head of the FCC, his newest head? A man who for 10, 12 years, and up until the last couple of years, he's been a hedge fund manager, right? What else? He was a major fundraiser for the president, which is why he got appointed. Forget about his morals or his integrity. Forget about it. He got this guy who he appointed, Thomas, I forget what his last name was the head of the major corporate industry group that controls something like half the media in this country and represented their interests, and he was one of their lobbyists and one of their major attorneys. This is the guy he puts in charge of protecting your right and my right to have freedom of speech and to have open communications on our licensed radio stations. Forget about the lesser of two evils. Next time around, I think we could all understand that it's time to find a decent third party to vote for and just keep voting in your local communities, vote on every possible level, and it'll get bigger and bigger and bigger. Also, follow what Mr. Lindsay here is doing at this corporate defense, this corporate anti-corporate defense fund for local communities. Work on a local level. Challenge the local the corporations on a local level using municipal, rules, state constitutions. This is how we get at them. They own the federal government. We have no control over it anymore. It's not in our interest. We have to start locally. It's Occupy. It's challenging local laws. It's challenging state laws. We'll work our way up from there. And that's how it's going to be. All right. That's it for this week.